All right, so this week's Parsha is Parsha's Toldos. And the question is a interesting question of how to handle a promotion. So we're going to go to a little video. Go to our videotape. And this is from, I'm going to prep the video. This is from the show on NBC called Chicago Fire. Has anybody seen that? I'll give you the basic explanation. I'll use their description. Chicago Fire, an edge of your seat view into the lives of everyday heroes committed to one of America's noblest professions. For the firefighters, rescue squad, and paramedics of Chicago Firehouse 51, no occupation is more stressful or dangerous, yet so rewarding and exhilarating. So this is the scene that we have the two protagonists, Lieutenant Casey has just become captain over his friend, Lieutenant Kelly Severide, and tension ensues. So here we go. There we go. Sharing the screen.
Hey guys, I've met with your lieutenant.
Yeah, sure thing, Casey. No worries.
What you're talking about. It made a lot of sense to try it that way. You really think it would have saved his leg?
Damage was done long before we got there.
So here's the thing, Severide. He had a victim bleeding out, and I had to choose between the fastest rescue and the most cautious one. I chose speed. But whatever the outcome, it's on my shoulders. Can't have you bucking the chain of command whether or not you think you know better. I don't expect you to be thrilled by my rank, but you need respect.
You're right. 100%.
I guess I can't blame him. Sure how well I'd take it if the shoe was on the other foot and Severide was telling me what to do.
But you ironed it all out.
The work part of it, at least. Might be a while before we take any fishing trips together. How do you find a balance between being a leader and being a friend?
You notice I don't have a lot of friends. Notice, I'm on my third marriage. It is the hand that wears the crown, Casey. The life of a leader is, it's a minefield. Figure out how to navigate it, you let me know.
There you go. All righty. All right. Okay, so we get back to our questions here. So prepping us for the shear. Okay. What challenge does being promoted pose for Captain Casey?
He was friends with all the people that he works with before he got promoted. Now it's hard to, you know, separate the two between friend and manager or supervisor.
Well, so one thing. So, and what is that challenge?
He's not looking at them, or they might not look at them as their superior. They look at him as their colleague, like he used to be.
Right, and the problem, and especially when you're functioning as firefighters, and you need to be somebody he's going to a dangerous situation. Can you that friendly sense of collegiality prevail?
Yeah.
Or can you be both leader and friend?
That's tough. I don't know.
Right.
I think you want to be a leader and you want to be a mentor, but sometimes it's easier not to be their friend when you have to make those tough life and death situations.
Right. So because the truth is, if you have the job of being a leader, they have to listen to you. And even if they think, A, it's unpopular, B, if even if they think that their idea is better, like it wasn't the case in that circumstance. So that's challenge number one. Okay, let's flip it around. What challenge did it cause for Lieutenant Severide, who's now the friend who did not get promoted?
He's a little resentful, maybe.
Okay, so he's resentful.
He wanted to get this person out a different way. Right. And he felt like he knew better, like he was more experienced maybe, and like he should have been promoted.
It's possible. I didn't watch the whole thing. But in general, what are the challenges of what are the challenges that in general when you have a office situation, everybody's hanging out and schmoozing during lunchtime and going out, and then one of the people get promoted to a manager, supervisor situation. How do the group who do not get promoted feel?
The people in the group who didn't get promoted will feel a certain resentment. Why not me? What did this person do better than I do? But then at the same time, it's harder for that friendship to maintain its friendship. Is you don't always want to go out to lunch with someone in a position higher than you.
Right. You can't be honest. You feel that you can't be completely yourself. In other words, the old schmoozing and fetching about the boss, you can't do when the guy actually is now the boss. you gotta be more careful that you're being conscientious. So it's a very uncomfortable situation. And of course, there's going to be jealousy. The jealousy from the lower one that this guy's not, as you said, Shana, this guy does not deserve it. And here's my question. How does that resentment show itself? What are different ways that the resentment animosity shows itself?
You question their leadership decisions?
Yes, for sure. What else?
Sometimes people will leave the organization.
Right, so that's in a very extreme circumstance. The person was like, is so dissatisfied that they felt that their friend was selected above, instead of them, they'll be so resentful they'll leave. That's true. That's an extreme thing. But assuming they're sticking with the organization, what other things?
Defiance.
Okay, for sure. Well, that was the situation in the video clip there. In other words, not listening. But if they are going to listen, they'll say they will listen. What's one step less confrontational than that?
Being passive aggressive, doing things begrudgingly.
And what else? Correct.
That's if they do even do what the person asks them to do.
Right, so either be confrontational and not listen to them, A. B, in front of them, compliant, but behind their back, not listening or doing the minimal possible. Or three, doing what they have to do, but complaining vociferously with the rest of the group who says, who does that guy think he is? Da, 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 da. So there's, many, many books, articles have written about what one does. Someone finds themselves confronted with the mixed blessing of being promoted when all your friends are not. It's not such a simple situation. It's actually very, very difficult. But let me ask you, what's going to happen realistically, even if you pull that off, to the friendship? Suzanne's shaking her hand. You want to clarify what the head shake refers to?
Yeah, it's not good. It's not going to be the same, because you have to respect the boundaries, and the boundaries are, they'll try to push boundaries, and your allegiances shift. So it's just, it's not a good thing. It doesn't last. Really, you may try to make that last, but it's very difficult. Unless you can completely say this is work and you have very clear-headed people, and I think most people unfortunately don't tend to be like that. All parties involved are very clear and have a lot of self-awareness. It doesn't typically end like that.
Right. So basically you lost a friendship. The friendship's over. Yeah. There might be at best a respectfulness at best, but the friendship was, we're all working together, we're in the same position, we're in the same, and we and part of the enjoyment is getting together and complaining about the bosses. But if one of them becomes the bosses, then there's that friendship has been largely undermined. And not to mention the aggression, like, why is this guy, you know, why is this schlump selected? Why was I overlooked, et cetera? And the aggression and the jealousy, yeah. All right, correct. So this awareness is relevant to our character, our main character. This is one of the most significant, this is in the lifetime, the Torah talks about Yitzchak as an actor, as a main protagonist, not being the, you know, not being a person who's acted on, but rather as being the main prime mover, as being the main protagonist. This chapter, chapter 26, is the main story of the active life of Yitzchak. Okay? And let's see what happens. Okay, so let's have somebody read. Let's do some reading here. Who volunteers? All right, Shane, again.
There was a famine in the land aside from the first famine in the time of Abraham. Yitzchak went to Avimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar.
So stop right there. Gerar is, there's a little bit of sort of a river, or a relatively small river, about 20 kilometers northwest of Beersheba. And it's not that far, for it's about, you know, 20 kilometers from the coast. It's a little bit inland from Gaza. You know what I'm saying? And this is where the archaeologists think the ancient Gerar was. Okay, so the whole situation, Hashem tells Avraham, we're going to skip the part where God talks to Yitzchak and say, "Don't go to Egypt." So we're going to skip that part, and he settles in Gerar. So we're skipping that part because that's another story. Go ahead.
Yitzchak farmed in the area. That year, he reaped 100 times as much as he sowed, for Hashem had blessed him. This was the beginning of his prosperity. He then continued to prosper until he became extremely wealthy. He had flocks of sheep, herds of cattle, and a large retinue of slaves. The Philistines became jealous of him. They plugged up all the wells that his father's servants had dug while Abraham was still alive, and they filled them with earth. Avimelech said to Yitzchak, "Go away from us. You have become much more powerful than we are." Yitzchak left the area and camped in the Gerar Valley, intending to settle there. He redug the wells that had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, which had been plugged up by the Philistines after Abraham's death. He gave them the same names that his father had given them.
Okay, stop right there. What are some of the questions that sort of leap off the page here?
Between Avimelech and like Yitzchak, were they like friends, or how were they to begin with?
So Yitzchak comes and moves into this community. Avimelech is the king of the Plishtim, and again, you know, like father, like son, he eventually actually takes They act as brother, do the old brother-sister game. Avimelech, the local land, the local king, takes, you know, Rivka, et cetera, the same thing, but then eventually returns her. I didn't go into that whole part. But he's a king he's like the feudal lord of that area, the regional king. There's no relationship. And he kicks him out when he becomes wildly successful.
Because he was the king, and like, how is this commoner becoming more powerful than I am?
Exactly.
It's like, it's a timeless tale of like jealousy and, you know, what happens when someone becomes, when you feel threatened by someone.
So at least Avimelech is honest. He kicks him out. He couldn't tolerate the fact that Scott said, a commoner or an immigrant, worse, had come into town during a famine, you know, and has this tremendous bumper crop, parlays that bumper crop into tremendous wealth, because God helped him, and everybody's jealous of him. So he says, go away, because you're more powerful than we are. So he kicked him out outside the town of Grar, into the Grar Valley, you know? Okay? But there's a very weird thing happening going on there. Something very strange, and look at verse 15.
Would the question be, why would they fill the wells if there's a famine?
Well, first of all of you guys have been to Israel. What is the climate of Israel?
It's very
hot and dry.
Very hot and dry. What is a prime resource?
Water.
So why, you know, and you, if you
they're hurting themselves. Yeah, they could have just taken the wells.
Right, so they could, if they're really aggressive and angry at Yitzchak, they should take control. As you say, as Scott's saying, they should take control of the wells. But what do? They do two things: they plug up the wells, and then they fill it into dirt, so they're no longer identified that there are wells there. You know what I'm saying? They do a double function here. Now, interestingly enough, who discovered these wells?
Avraham.
So the Torah goes out of its way to identify that these are the wells that Avraham's servants had dug while he was still alive, and they plugged them up and they filled them with earth. Which, as Scott says, like sort of like cutting out your nose despite your face. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, on a good year in Israel, it rains 21 times. So if you have water coming from the aquifer, you know, that's gold. That's worth more than gold. Okay? So that's a crazy...
Is that kind of like the Palestinians, like, destroying the greenhouses when we left Gaza?
That's a good analogy. It's literally in the same... And by the way, a mere 10 miles away from where this occurred. Maybe not even 10 miles, maybe 5 miles. Just to give you how things just are the same. There's a frame that Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim, the events of our forefathers is a foreshadowing for the descendants, for the children. So the things that happened to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in a certain sense, that those are the same fundamental conflicts keep on reasserting themselves.
Okay. My Zaidi used to say that the game doesn't change, only the players do.
And that is 1,000% correct here. 100%. So what did Yitzchak do?
He redug the wells and gave them the same name that his father gave them.
Okay, so what's up with that? What's strange about that?
What's the giving names to wells?
Right, I mean, you know, one thing it's clear that we all need the water. So if the Plishtim, not the Palestinians, the Plishtim, you know, we slipped there, the Philistines, are doing this kind of nonsensical violence and vandalism. Okay, the question is, so fine, so that makes sense. You should redug the wells because you need the water. But Yitzchak didn't just do that. He redug them, and then he named, gave them the same names of that his father had given them. Now, the question, of course, you know, what do you call it? Like Abe's Well? I mean, what did he, what were these names? You know, it seems to me if there's a common name, why did the Torah tell us about that they had names and that Yitzchak, you know, gave them the same names? I mean, that seems to be a little bit of a weird thing. All right, let's go on with the story. So let's go to scene number two. Go ahead, Shana.
Yitzchak's servants then dug in the valley and found a new well brimming over with fresh water. The shepherds of Gerar disputed with Yitzchak's shepherds, claiming that the water was theirs. Yitzchak named the well Challenge, Asek, because they had challenged him. They dug another well, and it was also disputed. Yitzchak named it Accusation, Sitna. He then moved away from there and dug another well. This time it was not disputed, so he named it Wide Spaces, Rehovot. Now Hashem will grant us wide open spaces, he said. We can be fruitful in the land. From there, Yitzchak went up to Beersheba. Hashem appeared to him that night and said, I am Hashem of your father Avraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you and grant you very many descendants because of my servant Avraham. Yitzchak built an altar there and called in Hashem's name. He set up his tents there, and his servants dug a well in the area. Avimelech came to Yitzchak from Gerar, along with a group of friends and his general, Pichol. Why have you come to me, asked Yitzchak? You hate me. You drove me away from you. We have indeed seen that Hashem is with you, they replied. We propose that there now be a dread oath between you and us. Let us make a treaty with you, that just as we did not touch you, you will do no harm to us. We did only good to you and let you leave in peace. Now you are the one who is blessed by Hashem. Yitzchak prepared a feast for them, and they ate and drank. They got up early in the morning and made a mutual oath. Yitzchak then bid them farewell, and they left in peace.
Okay. All right, so we asked the first few questions. I asked question number three. Why did the Pelishtim continue to oppose Yitzchak even after he moved out of town?
Resentment?
I think he's also a little scared of his power now. He's like, oh, no, this guy's got something to him. You know, like he even though he's pushing him out, he's afraid that, if he had enough, I think he knows his strength.
Okay. So you notice that Yitzchak and his staff dug three wells. What happened to the first two wells?
The people disputed them. They it was their land, their well.
Right. So they were saying, "What are you? They're fighting with Yitzchak and his people, saying, no, this is our well." So much so that Yitzchak named the well Asek, fighting challenge. And then he did another one, Sitna, accusation or aggression. Then what happened on the third well?
They didn't fight him for it.
Now that seems to be weird. Why they stopped fighting? Did they think the well was truly his? You know, what happens, why they run out of steam over here? Well, number one, they're fighting. Well, number two, they're fighting. Well, number three, they ran out of gas.
Yeah, like he didn't give up and they did, kind of thing.
Right. In other words, it's tug of war, and whoever lets go loses.
Right.
So and they let go.
you're just going to keep digging wells, so we're just not going to fight you on this one. We're too tired.
Okay, so they ran out of gas, they're too tired, they were just overcome by Yitzchak's power. Okay, that's part of it. And then, Yitzchak, for whatever reason, leaves. Now, after all that, then they're finally not hassling him. He goes, now, Beersheba, as I said, it's about 15 miles away, not so far away, but, you know, out of their sphere of God comes to them, and then Hashem builds an altar there, and he calls out in the name of God. He sets up tents there, and they dig another tent, another well, and then Avi Malik starts showing up. Suddenly, what's going on? The king shows up with his a small retinue of people. What's going on over there? Why is he showing up? In fact, Yitzchak says, why are you here? You hate me. You kicked me out. What's going on?
From the text, they say that they want to make peace with him, that they will leave him in peace if he leaves them in peace.
And why suddenly their big, why is there suddenly a new big peace movement now?
They recognize that Yitzchak has Hashem on his side.
Do they feel that he's going to attack them? Has Yitzchak shown any kind of aggression toward them? Is he like about to?
Could it be that like he keeps digging these wells and people keep taking them away? But like it, I don't. You didn't mention that they filled in these wells. Is it what?
They did not fill in the wells, and doesn't necessarily say that they won the fight. It just says that they fought him on it. They just gave him a hard time.
Right.
So okay. why now are they making a big treaty?
Because he's not trying to like take what the king has. He's just trying to like.
Right. So that's kind of strange. So if he seems from the verses not really a threat, why is he being visited by the king and his people to make this big oath over here?
Because they need his help for something?
Doesn't say that. The way they say it is, it says verse 28. We have indeed seen that God is with you. You propose that there be now a dread oath between you and me, a long-lasting, a bris, a covenant between you and us. Let's make a treaty with you. Just as we cannot touch you, you will not harm. You will not harm to us. We did only good to you, and let us leave in peace. Now that you are the one blessed by God. But in what they said, you can see what they're feeling. What is Avimelech feeling? Now, in psychology, there's an idea called projection. What is projection?
When you take the things you're feeling and say that somebody else is feeling them.
Right, correct. So, do we have any reason to believe that Yitzchak would have attacked and conquered Gerar?
No.
No. How does Avimelech feel? And prove from the text.
He feels dread. He wants a dread oath.
Right. Well, dread oath is a not a great translation. It means it's a long-lasting, it's a shvua. It's a significant, it's an oath, a promise when you do it in the name of God. It's a significant, the deepest possible promise. Yes. But why? Well, he says, you will not do harm. You will not harm us. You will do not harm to us. What does that mean? So if he feels that, that means he feels that that's a chance. That, in fact, Yitzchak would harm him. And this is a classic case of projection. Because basically, Avimelech imagines like this. If I had Yitzchak's power and money and resources, I would start to go conquering the countryside and start taking over because I have the power of God. I have the G-force, the God force. So Avimelech is doing a preemptive treaty so he won't get crushed. Because that's what he would do. Now he has no idea that Yitzchak is all about. Yitzchak is not interested in conquering nations. So that's why he's going on there. But we're going to get into that.
But doesn't he lie when he says, we only did good to you? They didn't do good to him. They messed up his wells to begin with.
Right. Yeah, it's a lie. Well, maybe that was not sanctioned. That was not an official. The people, in other words, the people who did it were not his people. So the municipality of Garar did not stop Abba's Wells. It was some of the commoners, without direction, also without protection from Avimel, did them. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So technically, you could argue, oh, well, yeah, I didn't do anything to you. Oh, but your people did, whatever. So that's a thing. Now, so I'm going to focus in on a little snippet from the Rambam. We mentioned this last week, but it's very important to see the role of, distinguish the role of Avram versus Yitzhak versus Yaakov. Let's have somebody read. Let me have Suzanne.
When the people would gather around Avraham and ask him about his statements, he would explain them to each one of them according to their understanding until they turned to the path of truth. Ultimately, thousands and myriads gathered around him. These are the men of the house of Avram. He planted in their hearts this great fundamental principle, composed texts about it, and taught it to Yitzhak, his son.
Okay, so stop right there. So basically, Avram was committed to teaching everybody about the one true God. And if they would come to him, whoever it was, whether it was a sophisticated person or an unsophisticated person, he would explain it customized to them. You know what I'm saying? To the extent that he would have tens of thousands of followers. Okay? Let's see how the Rambam depicts Yitzhak.
Yitzhak also taught others and turned their hearts to God.
Okay, stop. That's it. One sentence. And then read one more sentence.
He also taught Yaakov and appointed him as a teacher.
Okay, so look, contrasting the both, what's the difference between Avram and Yitzchak? Just from the Rambam's depiction of it, what's the difference?
Thousands gathered around Avram.
Okay. And what about Yitzchak?
Not so much.
Not so much. Okay, so in other words, clearly Avram had this amazing talent. In addition to discovering God himself, okay, he was blessed with this tremendous charismatic personality. He was a powerful educator that could teach it, whether he's talking to a second grader or a professor and everybody in between. He has the ability to engage them and convince them. Okay? Yitzchak, he also did it. But who does he seem to be his primary student? Who is Isaac's primary successful student?
Yaakov,
his son. In other words, when it says he gets to Be'er Sheva and he builds an altar and he calls on the name of God, calling on the name of God does not mean, it could be either means that he davened or he taught people in the area about Hashem. He did the same thing as Avram, but apparently he just did not have the immense, once in a civilizational talent is Avram. You know what I'm saying? Avram is the prophet being Yechezkel says, Echad Haya Avram. Avram was singular. There's only one Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu is amazing. Now let's go on to Jacob. Let's go on.
Yaakov taught others and turned the hearts of all those who gathered around him to God. He also taught all of his children. He selected Levi and appointed him as the leader. He established him as the head of the academy to teach them the way of God and observe the mitzvot of Avram.
Okay, so how did Yaakov shift the focus of the Abrahamic mission? But who's on 917 on the 846 number?
David?
Yeah. Hey, David, how are you? Welcome. I just didn't know.
Hey.
Good.
How are you?
Feel free to jump on in on any of the questions. Who's the Amanda, the 631. So how the question is, how did Yaakov shift the focus of the Abrahamic mission from Isaac? What's the change there?
The shift now is to the mitzvahs.
Well, I can assume that that's one. What else?
I mean, maybe it has to do something with sort of dividing some of the roles, and there's more people are teaching. It's not just like, you know, there's one teacher. I don't know.
Okay, well, that's part of it. So notice he says, Yaakov taught others and turned the hearts of all those who gathered around him to God. So people who hung out with the family, he taught them. He also taught all of his children. And he selected Levi and appointed him as the leader, sort of the Rosh Hashiva, the head of the academy.
It's the first Kirov organization.
Well, but really, Avram's the first Kirov organization.
Well, but Avraham taught people who wanted to learn. I feel like maybe now Yitzhak is sort of expanding, you know, like a Jewish by choice kind of thing, maybe. I don't know. A stretch.
So it seems to be there's a narrowing of the focus. Avram is successfully connecting to tens of thousands of people. Yitzchak seems to continue on, but doesn't seem to have that same magnitude of success. Yaakov also will teach those who are around him, but he's not going out like Avram and Yitzchak. And he's focusing on whom? Who's he focusing on and establish and institutionalizing? Who's the focus on now?
Levi
and his family. In other words, Yitzchak is now focusing on who is going to be the bearers of the Abrahamic tradition, the family, and anybody else who wants to hear. But he's sort of, instead of trying to work on the world, he's now focusing on the family. Okay. So either it could be because it's more of they were becoming more realistic, etc., or they didn't have the talents that Avram had, so they just focused their attention on the most important, you know, the people who are going to be the most impacted, which is the family. Now, I'm going to share tonight an insight about the names, and I think we're going to put everything into a package here. We're going to read a text from a rabbi from the 19th century called Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. He wrote a book called HaKetav HaKabbalah, which is a commentary on the Chumash. There's a commentary on the Chumash, but part of his Chumash was the polemic, was sort of a war against the brand new. He lived in Eastern Poland and Western, you know, modern Russia. And that was the birth of what they called the Reform Movement, and as well as the Enlightenment, you know, and also the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. Okay, so he's trying to, and part of his mission of this book is to show how the oral law emerges organically from the written law. So some of the things that when you had Rabbi Wild from Sinai to Manhattan, his part of his commentary on the Chumash is sort of demonstrating that from the text itself. Okay, so he has an interesting comment on this particular episode. So, and I got this from another great Torah educator, a woman, Nachama Leibowitz. Nachama Leibowitz passed away about 10, 15 years ago. She was an educator in Jerusalem. She went to University of Berlin, also with Rabbi Soloveitchik, and she wrote an immense amount of, and she taught many educators on the learning of Tanakh. She's one of the great Tanakh teachers. So she, in her book, she brings down this section from HaKetav HaKabbalah. So I'm going to have somebody read it. Who would like to volunteer reading the text here?
I can read if you want me to.
Good.
Okay. Start with and?
And, yeah.
Okay. And he called their names
which his father had called them. It is conceivable that Isaac's naming of the well bore affinity to other expressions of calling names to mark the kindness of the Lord, such as where it is stated that Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will see. The Lord is my sign, the well of him that liveth and seeth me. Keep going.
I can't, you're fading out. I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now? Abraham did see that. Abraham did the same thing with regard to the wells which he dug, calling them by the name of the Lord, since it was his preoccupation to spread abroad the knowledge of the Lord and show the people that idols were valueless. Abraham thought out a wonderful device to help to bring those who were misled under the wings of the divine presence. He called the well by a name that would drive home the lesson of the true existence of one God. By this, he would arouse in them an awareness of truth by saying, let us grow and draw water from the well of the eternal God. The wells were a public necessity, and in this matter, the people were initiated into a knowledge of the true God. Like the faithful servant of a king who tries to persuade rebellious, oh, I just lost my spot. Where was I? The wells were a public necessity, and in the matter, the people were initiated into a knowledge. Like the faithful servant of a king who tries to persuade rebellious subjects who had fled to return to their country, so that Abraham strove to turn the hearts of those who denied God. Whilst he was alive as the prince of God among them, his fear was upon them, and they left the wells intact with their names. But after his death, they reverted to idolatry, and in order to erase from their memory the names of these wells, which recalled the very opposite of their false opinions, they stopped up the wells. With the disappearance of the well, the name also disappeared. The Torah then comes to inform us that Isaac followed in his father's footsteps and endeavored to dig out these, the same wells, and resurrect their names in order to restore the crown of the true faith to its former glory.
Okay, so what is... So the Ketava Kabbalah here, this book, this commentary, Ray Mecklenburg, what does he suggest was the significance of the names? What's the significance of the names? Who could sort of summarize it for everybody?
Well, when I was younger, I thought that when they named the wells, I asked in class if it was idol worshiping. How can you name wells when you're naming something that's like abject? So I think the point is that the names that he chose was to give people sort of an awareness of Hashem. So it was okay. I remember my teacher said it was okay because the slogans that he chose was to show people how ridiculous it was to think that a thing like a well or a thing like something, and also Mayim, water is life. So that's another thing.
Right. So he would 100%. He called the names of the well. It doesn't tell us exactly what the names were, but there were some sort of like he called other places. The Lord will see. The Lord is my sign. The well of him that sees that lives and sees me. So he might have called them names that have to do with Hashem, which would, of course, so the person would come to the local well. It would have a sign that Abraham had constructed, which would sort of teach people or reinforce people the ideas about Hashem. And then he would maintain the public conversation. Now we understand why, in a drought, would these people want to not only fill them in, plug them up, but then cover them with dirt. What, based upon this, what was the motivation? Sean, what was the powerful motivation for them to, you know, to such aggressively and assertively shut them down? All right, Shana, what was the reason for the aggressive well stopping in the middle of a famine?
So the logic I'm having in my head is that in the famine, they're questioning if this God exists, this God of Abraham, why would there be a famine? And so they lose their faith in God, return to their idols, and to have their faith in their idols, they have to erase everything that connected them to Hashem.
Well, they did. It's interesting. They did not fill up the wells as soon as the famine started. It's only after Yitzchak became very wealthy.
They're jealous. They're angry. It's like a retaliation. It's like they're doing it by saying, like, we don't want this. Like, we don't want this from you. Like, but they're jealous. So when a little kid, like a sister and a brother, like it's a sister's birthday party and the brother gets jealous and like ruins one of the presents or something. It's an act of jealousy and they're angry.
Okay, so now here's a $64,000 question here. This is the tough question. If, as Rabbi Mecklenburg is arguing, that the names were the names of Avraham Avinu, and they reflected his ideology, and they were rebellious, and they wanted to be idolaters, so they didn't want a memory of that. The question, of course, is why didn't they stuff up the wells the day that Avram died? Why'd they only do it when Yitzchak became wealthy, which was seemingly, a decade or two later?
They didn't respect his son?
Well, if they didn't respect his son, why didn't they? So,
because Abraham wasn't a threat. Yitzchak is now a threat. It's like the little corner hardware store that now turned into Home Depot. He's turned into something bigger. They weren't really so bothered by Abraham.
Well,
like Abraham wasn't making a lot of noise, and his son is.
So what is that? Let's get this straight here. So when Abraham's alive, they wouldn't, and Abraham's a regional, well-known, internationally known person, they didn't touch the wells. Abraham dies. They still don't touch the wells. Then Yitzchak becomes wealthy. Then they go ahead. It says they became jealous, and they shoved, and they stopped up the wells. Let's understand the call. I think we're getting warm here. Why didn't they do it immediately after Yitzchak, after Avram died? If they were angry or aggressive or rebellious against the ways of Avram, so Avram's dead, fill in his wells, because it's part of his, you know, to use the term that Amanda says, that's part of his outreach. That's his hot kiddish. So is the wells with the names of God attached to it. Why didn't they shut it down immediately?
Because they weren't threatened. He's an extension of him now. Like Yitzhak is like, you know, it's like, it's bigger, it's better. It's like Abraham was like, whatever. It was just like this guy trying to do it. And then now Yitzhak is like, it's continuing, Lador Vador, from generation to generation. So it's a bigger threat.
Why didn't they stop it off right after Avram died?
Is it the timing of Yitzchak becoming wealthy and reaping so much in time of a famine?
Yeah. So how does that fit in? That's my question to you both. In other words, if you're saying they didn't like, as Rabbi Mecklenburg is saying, if they didn't like Avram's message, so the day after his funeral, they should have filled in Avram's outreach wells, okay? But they didn't.
Because it wasn't a threat when Avraham died. It was more of, like Yitzhak turns onto their radar, like they were jealous of him. They weren't necessarily jealous of Avraham.
The son was using the wells differently than the father was, and the father could have done what he did and gotten rich, but he didn't. So they weren't threatened by him.
You're touching on the key point there, Scott. In other words, when Avram died, Avram's force seemingly had disappeared. Avram's gone. So Avram's philosophy, Avram's way of life, which they found threatened by, had disappeared. And they looked at his son as being a little, what they call, like in Yiddish, a little pisher. He's insignificant. He's not a force.
Right.
He's got, like, you know, he's in fact, not only that, he's an immigrant living, you know, in our town under our, you know, our largesse out of our kindness of our heart. And he's a guy running from the famine and enjoying being close to the Gerar River. But then something happened. Avram becomes phenomenally wealthy. Now he's become phenomenally wealthy in a famine year, but he becomes more wealthy so much so the king is more wealthier than the king. So what fear comes to their mind?
That he will overthrow the king and install his, you know, way of living, like.
Well, either
you will pray to the God of Abraham, you know, so, not your idols.
So I'm not sure if they go all the way. That's a possibility. In other words, either A, they imagine that basically Yitzchak is going to take over and by force them all to follow the religion of Abraham. One possibility, or at the very least. They're afraid of this rising force. This guy's becoming a star.
I think they're afraid of a mutiny.
Okay, so here's the key thing, which is true for all people who become successful. When a person has a little bit of success, going back to our movie in a little clip, by Captain Casey and Lieutenant Severide. So when a person becomes initially successful, gets a promotion. What are people's initial reaction? What do they try to do?
It depends. It depends if you're actually genuinely happy with that person or if you don't really like them.
Okay, obviously, if you're as to quote Suzanne, if you're a very well-developed person, you're not threatened because your sense of self is intact. But most people are not well-developed and they feel inadequate, so therefore they oftentimes will feel threatened. So the initial approach is to sort of be, we talked about all the different kinds of opposition. Either A, not listen to their commands, B, privately undermine them, whatever it is. Now let me ask you this question, Suzanne. What will imagine is going to happen if in the TV series of Chicago Fire, if Captain Casey remains the captain for the next 5 years? What's going to be Lieutenant's Severide's attitude in 5 years from now?
Towards Casey?
Yeah, Captain Casey.
He's not... Well, the friendship's over, and he'll either have to adjust or maybe a little... The promoted person is going to have to probably prove himself to this person.
For sure, but after 5 years, the conflict is over. In other words, the people will have already accepted him as an authority.
Right.
So let's take it step by step here. Step one, Avram's in town. When Avram's around, Avram, as the Ram described, is profoundly successful, wealthy, charismatic educator. And he creates a series of wells, which he names related to God's name, so people will be reminded about the ideas of Avram trying to promote. Then Avram dies. What does everybody think? The Abrahamic religion is now over. Avram was the great man. His wife Sarah was the great woman. They were the power couple. They're dead. It's over. Judaism had a short run. It had a great and glorious beginning, phenomenal middle, and now it's over. Because it's only he produces little guy Yitzchak, and Yitzchak does not seem to be gifted with the same charismatic strength as Avram. Doesn't seem to have the same series of talents. In fact, he does not. What happens? In a famine, he comes to Gerar. With God's help, he's able to produce 100 times the amount of income from his fields. He parlays that into great wealth. People become jealous. They're afraid on two levels. One is that they view him as a political threat, like Abimelech does, the king. And two, they're afraid that he's going to reinstate the grandeur of the Abrahamic tradition. What do? A little, passive aggressive. They shove up the wells, which Abram had named. What does Yitzchak do?
He redigs the wells and gives them the same name that Abraham gave them.
What is he really saying?
You can't stop me.
You cannot stop me.
Makes you stronger, stands a little taller.
Exactly.
Vader's going to hate, right?
Thanks to them, there's a new sheriff in town, ladies and gentlemen, and his name is Yitzchak. Avram may have died, but I am teaching and promoting the same ideas, and I will not be, nobody's going to close my store on this watch. But is the fight over? Are the people done fighting?
No, they take over the wells again.
Well, then he digs a brand new well. What do? They fight. They say, what are you talking about? That's your well? That's our well. They start to fight and argue that the well that his staff, his servants had found was not their well. Okay? So that's a big fight. Then he digs a second well. What happens in the second well?
Same thing.
They continue fighting. Because is the fight really about the well?
No, it's about stopping the family, the religion.
Right. They're not trying, it's not simply shutting down the way of trying to undermine Avram and the Yitzchak's reaffirming of Avram's influence is via the wells. Then he gets to the third well, he digs the third well, they don't bother him. What's happened there? What really happened there?
They realize that, you know, they can keep, you know, stop taking over these wells and he'll just keep digging new ones. It's just like he'll keep doing it until he wins.
He's unstoppable. He's unstoppable and he ain't going away. And by extension,
they underestimated him.
Correct. And this is true with anybody, whether you have a person who's a musician, a singer, an actor, a business person, anytime in the early stages of success, people come to oppose them because they're jealous and they try to undermine them. But if they gain a little success to a certain extent, then there's a point where they accept them as being, he's now somebody we have to reckon with it. And what's the final phase? That even though he moved away 15 miles away, who comes and knocking at his door?
The king.
The king himself. The king says, Yitzchak, can we make a peace treaty so you won't hurt us? He's afraid that basically Avram, because they imagine that, well, that's what he would do. He thinks that Yitzchak is going to continue to gain power and retaliate for all the bad behavior they visit upon him, even though he says, we did nothing wrong to you, which he knows is not 100% the truth. So the bottom line is the story of the wells, which seems to be about, you know, water rights in the Middle East, really is a story of, it tells us the idea of Yitzchak. That Yitzchak is he's reestablishing, maintaining the tradition, religion, values, philosophy of Avram. And even that gets a whole bunch of blowback until he maintains the course. He is consistent. He is insistent. And he is, most importantly, persistent. Therefore, they give up. And they accept him as being the reality. Yitzchak is not going away. And they have to accept him as being part of the leadership. Okay? Now, this is significant to our lives because many times whenever a person's on going on a personal journey, you know, I see this all the time in MG years, when people in MG years are going on a personal journey, many times not everybody in the family and friends is going, yay! You know, they're very, oh, you're starting to be more observant and keeping kosher. Fantastic. Doing a little more Shabbos. Wonderful. You know, doing this mitzvah, doing that mitzvah. Not every family member or friend is giving a rousing standing ovation. Many times they are feeling, rejected. And they will try to stop it by pushing back and pushing down. But the bottom line is, and I'm, you know, there's a whole strategy of how to handle that in an intelligent, thoughtful way. But the case is that when a person's having success personally in your Jewish growth and your personal growth, that you see from Yitzchak is that being insistent, consistent, and persistent, and whole, you know, and maintaining your values, and doing it in a thoughtful way, does win the day, and ultimately does win people's respect. And ultimately, Avimelech came back to Yitzchak saying, I would like to make an oath with you. I see Hashem is with you. I want there to be peace with us. And Yitzchak, who's a peace lover, says, sure, come. And he makes them a big party. And then they make the oath, the covenant with each other. And then everybody goes in their merry way. And basically the story of Yitzchak is a person who was not gifted with all the amazing talents of Avram. He wasn't Avram number two. You know, there's in every organization, there's the founder, the person who has the great idea and pushes it to make it happen. And then there's a second generation, which is the maintainer. And that's not so simple. To maintain the dream and to maintain the vision is a tough job also. And that was really Yitzchak's role. Yitzchak was not he didn't expand the business. He maintained the business. And he kept it for another generation to his son Yaakov, and Yaakov to his 12 sons, and until we have, you know, ultimately we have the Jewish people today. But, you know, everybody likes the rock star, the amazing, leader such as Avram, but being a maintainer and holding the line through life's ups and downs is also significant. And that really is the story of the wells. And the opposition that Yitzchak faced with his area. And I didn't even go in the story of where they took his wife. That's another opposite, you know, another challenge that he faced. But we couldn't do all the stories. Is that clear? So going back to the handling of promotion, it's not simple. You have to be aware that there'll be a lot of aggression and there'll be dissatisfaction. There's an art to do this. There's actually a lot of good books and articles about how to do that in general. And in general, when you have success, whether it be a personal success in your growth, whether it be a Jewish growth or professional growth or a social growth and development, how to deal with the blowback is not so simple. And we learned from Yitzchak how to navigate those difficult waters. Any questions, anyone? All right.
No.
Actually, I do.
Good.
I have a few, actually.
All right. We'll go for a few.
Okay, so first question is, the well that was named Rehovot, is that near where modern-day Rehovot is in Israel?
I don't think so.
Okay. Second question is, why did Yaakov choose Levi to be the teacher?
That is a very interesting question. The Rama's gathering this from the Midrashim. Because for example, the Midrash says that the tribe of Levi never did idolatry in Egypt. So, but if you look how Yaakov speaks to Levi, he excoriates him and Shimon and Levi, because what do? He curses their anger, because with their anger they went and they basically killed the city of Shechem. So it's not clear from the text where you see that Levi was selected to be the main religious leader. Okay? But that's established in the Midrash. So I don't know what is the evidence in the actual written text for that idea. Well, that seems to be a well-accepted idea among the Midrashim and the Talmud, that Levi was special. You see later on that they're selected to be the tribe of Levi, which the Levi and the Kohanim are from. And Moshe blesses the tribe of Levi as being the religious leadership. But that's sort of afterwards. How do you know that the first Levi? Now, you could argue like this. Now that I'm playing with the quest a little more, let me ask you a little question. Where did Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam come from?
The tribe of Levi.
Yes, their father was Amram, who's going back to like the grandfather or the great great, and their great great was Levi. So I guess they're arguing that is it coincidental that the three all-star prophets, you know, the Hall of Famers, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam, came out of nowhere, or they were special initially?
When they were in Egypt, though, from Yosef until Moshe, wasn't it the tribe of Levi that kept the mitzvot?
Right, but I'm saying, but how do we know, but that's not written in the text. The Midrash says that. You're asking me, how do we know that there not seems to be any open verse that supports that, but the Midrash, where the Rambam gathers that from, does support that. That Levi was apparently special. And he was apparently, the Rambam makes the assertion that he was picked to be the head of the Academy of Learning. So the Jews had a yeshiva in Egypt. And they did produce some amazing people. And the Midrash says that they didn't do idolatry. And ultimately, they're picked to be the tribe of Levi, which are the who do the national service. Now, so you could draw the conclusion from the end to the beginning, but that's not 100%. I have to do a little research. What is the source from the verses that supports a leadership role for Levi? I don't know. You stumped the rabbi, which is always good. I like getting stumped. Anybody else? All right. Okay, guys. Have a great night, and I'll see many of you tomorrow.
Have a good night. See you tomorrow.
Good night.